hit her just over her right cheekbone. Her head snapped back and then forward. It might have been Lucio's body, but it was the corpse taker's expression of shock and surprise as the stolen body fell to the ground in a loose tangle of dead limbs. I heard a low, strangled sound. I looked up to see Morgan standing in the building's doorway, sword in hand. He stared at Lucio's corpse and rasped, "Captain?" I stared at him for a second and then fumbled for words.
"Morgan, this isn't what it looks like."
Morgan's dark eyes rose to focus on me, and his face twisted with rage.
"You..."
His voice was deadly quiet. The sword rose to a guard, and he stalked out into the rain, and his voice rose to a wrathful roar as the freaking ground, began to literally shake.
"Murderer! Traitor!"
Oh. Chapter 40. Morgan lashed his fist out at me, shouting something that sounded vaguely Greek, and the very rocks of the earth rippled up in a wave that flew toward me with incredible speed. I had never fought against earth magic in earnest before, but I knew enough about it to not want to be in the way when it got to me. The gun went back in my pocket, and I took my staff in hand and ran for the nearest tree. I thrust the staff back at the earth as I ran, gathered in my will, and shouted,
"Forzare!"
Unseen force lashed out at the ground behind me and flung me up at an angle. I hit the branches of the tree maybe 10 feet up and scrambled wildly to grab one. I did it, and though it shook the tree like a blow from a giant axe, the wave of power went by under me without, sucking me under the ground or crushing me or anything like that. I can't imagine that whatever Morgan had in mind was less than horribly violent. Morgan bellowed in rage and charged toward me, sword in hand. I jerked my legs up, and he missed my ankles, if not by much. He snarled in rage, whirled with the silver sword of the wardens, abruptly emitting a low howling sound, and struck at the trunk of the tree in a motion of focus and power that reminded me of way too many Kurosawa movies. There was a flash of light as the blade cut all the way through the tree's trunk, the heat of all that force setting both sides of the tree on fire as the tree started to fall. I dropped clear and rolled as the tree fell out toward the street, and Morgan darted to one side, trying to get around the fallen tree to kill me.
"Morgan!" I shouted. "For God's sake, man, that wasn't Lucio!"
"Lies!"
Morgan snarled. He abandoned chasing me around the tree in favor of simply hacking his way through it, and the sword in his hands howled again and again as he struck, cutting trunk and branches like bits of straw.
"It was the corpse taker!" I shouted. "The body thief! She let Lucio gut her and then switched places with her!"
His answer was an almost incoherent snarl. He came the last several feet faster than I could have believed and lashed at me with a sword. I brought my shield up and deflected the blow, but the impact of it slammed painfully against the whole left side of my body. There was more than simply physics behind that blade. I backpedaled out into the street, where several more zombies saw me and headed my way. Specters darted or looped lazily about now, with no sense of purpose in them at all, now that their drum was silent and the corpse taker was dead.
"Morgan!" I screamed. "Lucio might still be alive, but not if she doesn't get help, and soon. We can't do this!"
"More lies!"
He murmured something. The blade in his hands hummed as Lucio's had, and he flicked it lightly out against my shield. There was a shrieking scream. In my head rather than in my ears. I don't know how to describe it, except to say that bad audio feedback is musical and soothing by comparison. The power in the silver sword hit my defensive shield and simply undid it, unraveled it, so that all the energy in it went flying apart in all directions, while a hot, tingling pain flashed through my left arm where I wore the bracelet. Morgan attacked in earnest after that little flick of the blade had destroyed my defense, but his first swing was an overhand one, aimed at my temple. I knocked the blade aside with a sweep of my staff, and saw a flash of surprise cross his face at the speed of the parry. He recovered his balance, but I simply ran from him, taking that vital second to get moving again. Morgan cursed and followed me, but I can move, especially for a man my size, and Morgan wasn't exactly a spring chicken. I gained 10 or 12 feet on him before my legs suddenly became unsteady and I faltered and nearly fell. I wanted to scream in frustration, though I didn't feel how much pain my body was in. It was battered and weak. There was no way I could simply outrun him, but I made it back over to where my dinosaur stood, restlessly idle after driving away the specters. I got close enough to touch her and slapped at her flank, desperately willing my intentions to her tiny brain. Doubtless savvy necromancers had ways of conveying their orders over a distance, but I was new at this, and I had no intentions of refining my technique any time soon. Sue spun around as Morgan charged, leaned down low, and opened her vast jaws in a bellow of challenge. Say what you will about Morgan, the man was no coward. But the bellow of an angry tyrannosaur is enough to give any mammal a moment or two of doubt. He slid to a halt on his heels, still grasping the sword in his left hand, and stared at Sue, and then at me. He took a deep breath and then reached out his right hand, where there was a low, yawning, humming sound that shook the air around his fingers.
No, he said quietly. Not even this creature will keep you from justice this time, Dresden. Even if I have to die doing it.
I stared at Morgan, the same old frustration and fear suddenly yielding to a realization. I had always assumed that Morgan's irrational hatred was something personal, reserved for me and me alone. I had assumed that for whatever reason, Morgan's persecution was the result of the political and philosophical enmity of certain members of the White Council, that he was nothing but a pawn for someone higher up in the game. But politicians don't make good kamikazes. That kind of dedication is reserved for zealots of principle and lunatics. For the first time, I considered the notion that perhaps Morgan's hate was not directed at me personally, but at those that he truly believed to be violators of the laws of magic, murderers and traitors. I knew people who would face death, even embrace it, rather than surrender their principles. Karen Murphy was one of them, and I was friends with most of the rest. At the end of the day, Morgan was a cop. He worked for a different body of law, of course, and under a different set of guidelines, but his duties were the same. Pursue, combat, and apprehend those who violated the laws put in place to protect people from harm. He'd spent more than a century as a policeman, dealing with some of the more nightmarish things on the planet. Thinking of him in that light suddenly gave me a different understanding of Morgan's character. I'd seen burned-out cops before. They'd labored long and hard in the face of danger and uncertainty to uphold the law and protect the victims of crimes, only to see both the law and the victims it should have protected broken, beaten, and abused again and again. It mostly happened to the cops who genuinely cared, who believed in what they were doing, who passionately wanted to make a difference in the world. Somewhere along the way, their passion had become bottled anger. The anger had fermented into bitter hatred. Then the hatred had fed upon itself, gnawing away at them over years, even decades, until only a shell of cold iron and colder hate remained. I didn't feel contempt for burned-out cops. I didn't feel anger toward them. All I ever felt was sadness and empathy for their pain. They'd seen too much in their daily battle against criminals. 10 or 20 or 30 years of witnessing the most monstrous aspects of humanity had slowly turned them into walking casualties of war. And Morgan had been on his beat for more than a century. Morgan didn't hate me. He hated the bad guys. He hated the wizards who abused the power he had dedicated his life to using to protect others. When he looked at me, he didn't see Harry Dresden. He could only see the atrocities and tragedies that had burned themselves into his mind and heart. I understood him. It didn't make me like him, but I could understand the pain that drove him to persecute me. Of course, my sensitivity and empathy were completely irrelevant because they wouldn't do a damn thing to stop him. If he charged me, I wouldn't have any options.
Morgan, I rasped, please don't. We can't let Corpse Taker divide us like this. Can't you see that? That was her intention when she took Lucio. Traitor, he snarled. Liar.
I ground my teeth in frustration.
My God, man, thousands of people are about to die.
His mouth twisted, baring his teeth all the way to the gums.
And you will be the first.
If he charged me again, I wouldn't have any choice but to fight. and he was at least as strong as me, and far more experienced, not to mention the enchantment-breaking silver sword in his hand. If I didn't kill him fast, he would kill me. It was as simple as that. And even if I did kill him, he would spend his death curse on me, and it wouldn't be like the feeble thing Cassius had thrown. Morgan would obliterate me. I couldn't run. I couldn't survive fighting him, regardless of whether or not I beat him. The best I could hope for would be to take him with me. If I died, Sue would go wild, reverting to the instincts of her ancient spirit. She would hunt. People would die. But if Morgan died, it would leave only Kowalski and Ramirez to stop Cowell and Gravain. Even if they could manage to pull off some kind of necromancy to shield them from the vortex as they went in, they would never be able to beat the necromancers within. They would certainly die, and not long after that, the Dark Hallow would annihilate thousands of innocent lives. With Morgan leading them, they might have a chance. Not a good one, but at least there was a chance. Which meant that if I wanted to stop the Dark Hallow and save all those lives, I had only one choice. I leaned my suddenly trembling hand against Sue's leg, and she sank back into a passive crouch. Morgan let out a bellow of defiance and determination and rushed me. I lowered my shield. My heart pounded with a fear so strong that I nearly threw up. The lightning gleamed on the silver blade of his sword. I dropped my staff to the ground and faced him, arms at my sides, my hands clenched into terrified fists. I readied my will, my own death curse, picturing Gravain in my thoughts. At least I could give the wardens a better chance for victory if I could kill or cripple one of the bastards on my way out. Time stretched out into an endless moment. I watched Morgan's sword sweep up to the vertical, the blade a gorgeous silver that reflected the lightning ripping apart the spinning vortex behind me.
"Harry!"
Butters screamed, his voice horrified, the drum pounding frantically. As Morgan struck, I took the coward's way out and closed my eyes. I knew that it was inevitable that one day I would die, but I didn't want to watch it coming. Chapter 41. A gunshot rang out. Morgan jerked at the hips, suddenly thrown off balance. He spun gracelessly and fell to the ground. I stared at him in shock. Morgan let out a snarl, fixed his eyes on me, and lifted his right hand, deep and terrifying power gathering in it.
"Morgan!"
snapped a woman's voice. That voice rang with authority and confidence, with command. The speaker damn well knew that when she gave an order, that it would be obeyed, and imbued the command with a power that had nothing to do with magic.
"Stand down!"
Morgan froze for an instant and glanced over his shoulder. Ramirez stood 20 feet away, his pistol smoking in his hand. The other arm was supporting the weight of the girl I had known as the corpse taker. The girl's face was as pale as death, and she could not possibly have been standing on her own, but though her features were exactly the same as when corpse taker had been in the body, she did not look like the same person. Her eyes were narrowed and hard, and her expression was filled with a stern, almost regal confidence.
"You heard me," the girl snapped. "Stand down."
"Who are you?"
Morgan asked.
"Morgan," Ramirez said. "Dresden was telling the truth. This is Captain Lucio."
"No,"
Morgan said, shaking his head, but his voice lacked his usual absolute conviction.
"No. It's a lie."
"It's no lie," Ramirez said. "I soulgazed her. It's the captain."
Morgan's lips worked soundlessly, but he didn't release the strike he held ready in his hand.
"Morgan," the girl said, quietly this time. "It's all right. Stand down."
"You aren't the captain," Morgan mumbled. "You can't be. It's a trick."
The girl, Lucio, abruptly put on a lopsided smile.
"Donald," she said, "dear idiot, I'm the one who trained you. I am fairly certain that you do not know as much as I do about who I am."
Lucio lifted her arm and showed Morgan the silver rapier she'd carried before. She took it in her hand and whipped it in a circle, eliciting a steady, humming power as I'd felt before.
"There. Could another so employ my own blade?"
Morgan stared at her for a moment. Then his hand dropped, suddenly limp, the power he'd held draining away. My heart started beating again, and I leaned heavily against Sue's flank. Ramirez holstered his gun and helped the new Lucio over to Morgan's side, then lowered her gently to the ground beside him. "You're hurt," Morgan said. His own face had gone white with pain. "How bad is it?" Lucio tried a small smile.
"I'm afraid I aimed too well. The wound has done for me. It may take some time, that's all."
"My God," Morgan said. "I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I saw Dresden shoot you, and while you were bleeding, needed help."
Lucio raised a weak hand.
"No time," she said gently.
Ramirez had bent over Morgan, meanwhile, and was examining the gunshot wound. The bullet had caught Morgan in the back of one leg, and it looked messy.
"Damn it," Ramirez said.
"It hit his knee. It's shattered." He placed his fingers lightly over Morgan's knee, and the older warden abruptly twisted in pain, his face gone bloodless.
"He can't walk."
Lucio nodded.
"Then it's up to you."
She looked over at me.
"And you, Warden Dresden."
"What about Kowalski?" I said.
Ramirez paled. He glanced back at the apartment building and shook his head.
"He was sitting on the floor when the specters rose out of it. He never had a chance."
"No time," Lucio said weakly. "You must go."
Butters came marching over to us, drum still beating, his face pale.
"Okay," he said. "I'm ready. Let's do it."
"Not you, Butters," I said. "Sue just needs to be able to hear the drum. She'll hear it over there just as well as if you were on her back. I want you to stay here."
"But I can't afford to spare effort to protect you," I told him. "And I don't want to leave the wounded here alone. Just keep the drum beating." "But I want to go with you. I want to help. I'm not afraid to..."
He swallowed, face pale.
"Die fighting beside you."
"Look at it this way," I said. "If we blow it, you get to die anyhow." Butters stared at me for a second and then said,
"Gee, now I feel better."
"I believe that there's a cloud for every silver lining," I said. "Come on, Ramirez." Ramirez's grin returned. "Everyone else who lets me ride on their dinosaur calls me Carlos." I climbed back up into the first saddle and Ramirez settled into the second.
"God be with you, Harry,"
Butters said, marching in place on the ground, his face worried. Given whom I had chosen as my ally, I sort of doubted that if God went with me, it would be to assist me. "I'll take whatever help I can get," I said aloud, and laid my hand on Sue's hide. She lurched up from her crouch, and I turned her toward the site of the vortex.
"You're hurt," Ramirez said.
He kept his voice pitched very low.
"I can't feel it," I said.
"I'll worry about the rest of theirs a later. You've got great timing, by the way. Thank you."
"De nada," he said. "I was right behind Morgan. I heard you trying to talk to him about Lucio."
"You believed me?" I started Sue forward. It would take her several steps to pick up speed. Ramirez sighed.
"I've heard a lot about you. Watched you at the council meeting. My gut says you're okay. It was worth checking out."
"And you soul-gazed her. That was some fast thinking and good shooting."
"I'm brilliant as well as skilled," he said modestly. "It's a great burden. All of that on top of my angelic good looks, but I try to soldier on as best I can."
I let out a short, rough laugh.
"I see. I hope I won't embarrass you then. Did I not mention my nearly godlike sense of tolerance and forgiveness?"
Sue gathered speed, and I turned her down the street.
"Hey," he said, "the bad guys are back that way."
"I know," I said.
"But they're expecting an attack from that direction. I'm going to circle the block, try to come in behind them."
"Is there time?"
"My baby can move," I told him.
Sue broke into her run, and the ride smoothed out. Ramirez let out a whoop of pure enjoyment.
"Now this is cool," he said. "I can't even imagine how complicated this must have been."
"Wasn't complicated," I told him.
"Oh? So summoning up dinosaurs is actually very easy, is it?"
I snorted.
"Any other night, any other place. I don't think I could have done it, but it wasn't complicated either. Lifting up an engine block isn't complicated. It's just a lot of work."
Ramirez was silent for a moment. I'm impressed, he said. I didn't know Ramirez very well, but my sense of him told me that those were words he was not in the habit of uttering. When you do something stupid and die, it's pathetic, I said. When you do something stupid and survive it, then you get to call it impressive or heroic. He let out a rueful chuckle. What we're doing right now, he said, his voice softened and lost its edge of brash arrogance, is pathetic, isn't it? Probably, I said. On the other hand, he said, recovering, if we survive it, we're heroes. Medals, girls, endorsements, cars. Maybe they put us on a cereal box. Seems the least they could do, I said. So, we've got two of them left to take down. Who do we hit first? Gravain, I said. If he's holding a bunch of zombies as guard dogs, he isn't going to have a lot of attention to spare for defensive spells, or for throwing anything else at us. We hit him fast. Hopefully put him down before he can try anything. He handled a chain like he knew how to use it when I saw him fight Corpse Taker. Ugh, Ramirez said. Nasty. Anyone who knows their way around a Kusari is a tough customer. Yeah, so we shoot him. Damn right we shoot him, Ramirez said. This is why so many of the younger members of the council like the way you do things, Dresden. I blinked. They do? Ah, hell yes, Ramirez said. A lot of them, like me, were apprentices when you were first tried after Justin DeMorn's death. A lot of them are still apprentices, but there are people who think highly of what you've done. Like you? I would have done a lot of those things, he said, only with a lot more style than you. I snorted. Second one we'll hit calls himself Cowl. He's good. I've never seen a wizard stronger than he is, and that includes Ebenezer McCoy. A lot of guys who hit hard have a glass jaw. Bet he's all offense. I shook my head. No, he's just as good at protecting himself. I flipped a car over on top of him, and it barely slowed him down. Ramirez frowned and nodded. How do we take him down, then? I shook my head. Haven't thought of anything good. Hit him with everything and hope something gets through. And if that wasn't enough, he's got an apprentice with him, called Kumori, who seems personally loyal. She's probably strong enough to be on the council herself. Damn, Ramirez said quietly. She pretty? She keeps her face covered, I said. No idea. If she was pretty, I'd just turn on the Ramirez charm and have her eaten out of my hand, he said. But I can't take chances with that kind of power if I'm not sure she's pretty. Used recklessly, it could endanger innocent bystanders or land me in bed with an ugly girl. Can't have that, I said, turning Sue around another corner. I checked the vortex. The slender, spinning pseudo-tornado was more than halfway to the ground. All right, then, Ramirez said. Once we're past Gravain, I'll take on the apprentice. You go for Cowl. I glanced back at him with an arched eyebrow. If we ignore Kumari, she'll be free to take us both out. One of us has to counter her. You're stronger than me, he said, his tone matter-of-fact. Don't get me wrong. I'm so damn good that I make it look easy, but I'm not stupid. You have the best shot at taking Cowl down. If I can drop the apprentice, I'll help. Sound like a plan? Sounds like a plan, I said. I just wish it sounded like a winning plan. You got a better idea? Ramirez asked me cheerfully. No, I said, and I turned Sue down the street that would hopefully let us attack the necromancers from the rear. Well then, he said, his smile ferocious. Shut up and dance! Chapter 42. The campus of the college consisted of only a few buildings. A couple of dorms, a couple of buildings with classrooms, the Mitchell Museum, and an administrative office. The area between them was a nicely kept lawn, too small to look like a park, but larger than you want to mow every week. At the center of the area, directly in front of the museum, picnic tables had been overturned onto their sides around a large circle, open to the skies above. I slowed Sue's steps for a moment to try to get some kind of idea of what we had to contend with. Standing in silent ranks around that circle were Gravain's style of undead. Very solid, very physical, though there were relatively few of them in the half-rotted or desiccated condition of the corpses that had attacked my place. These undead looked like they might still have been saved by a snappy EMT. They all looked like Native American tribesmen, just as Corpse Taker's specters had, though the styles of clothing and weaponry were slightly different. One other thing was different, too. These undead radiated a kind of hideous, ephemeral cold, and their skin almost seemed to glow with its own pale, horrible light. I could sense the raw power that lay within them, even from 100 yards away. These undead were different from those that had attacked the wardens, as different as an old pickup truck was from a modern battle tank. These zombies would not be so easily destroyed as those others, and were likely to be far stronger, far faster. They stood in ranks around the inner circle, facing outward, but they ranked thicker between the circle and the last location of the wardens than on the side nearest us. I had managed to outflank the thinking of whoever had those undead in position, and the thought cheered me somewhat. Spirits and specters and formless masses of luminescent light darted and flowed around the circle like strands of kelp and bits of algae caught in a whirlpool. They were all the same unpleasant colors as the lightning in the storm, and even as I watched, their numbers visibly grew. Sue paced a restless step forward, and I felt a horrible sensation of cold on the skin of my face and forehead, as if the hovering vortex above was casting out some kind of perverted inversion of sunlight. I crouched a little lower on Sue's back, and the feeling faded. Lightning flashes from different directions cast a web of shadows over the whole place, trees and buildings collaborating with the storm to conceal much of the open circle, continually clothed in shifting blocks and threads of darkness. I could see that there was someone within the circle of picnic tables, but not who, and I couldn't even be sure of how many. "That," I said in a low voice, "is a lot of badass zombies."
"And ghosts," Ramirez said.
"And ghosts."
"Look at it this way," he said. "With that many of them, how can we miss?"
"Yeah," I said.
"Cool."
I didn't want to do it. I wanted to go find myself a hole and crawl into it. But instead I put my hand on Sue's neck, drew her attention to the zombies, and willed her forward into battle. Sue leapt forward and hit the nearest rank of zombies before any of them had the chance to notice her. She tore one apart with her vast jaws, smashed several others flat, crushed some with her flailing tail, and generally went to town. After her devastating initial charge, I heard a frantic man's voice shout from within the circle, and the zombies turned to attack. The zombies whipped out bows and spears and clubs, or else tore at Sue with their bare hands. It wasn't pretty. Arrows streaked through the air with unnatural speed. And when they struck the Tyrannosaur's hide, they sounded almost like gunshots. One zombie rammed a spear cleanly through the massive muscle of Sue's right thigh. A swinging club shattered several of her teeth, and even as I watched, an unarmed zombie leapt up onto her flank, got a hold of the heavy extension cord that held the saddles in place, then drove his fist into her flesh up to the elbow and started raking out gobbets of tissue by the handful. I brought up the sparkling blue cloud of my shield bracelet in time to intercept an arrow, and others smashed against it with the force of bullets even as I held it in place. Without being told, I felt Ramirez turn to our right, his own left hand extended, and a concave disc of green light expanded web-like from his outstretched fingertips, covering that flank from still more of them. But as vicious and as strong and as swift and deadly as the zombies were, they couldn't hold a candle to Sue. The injuries that might have terrified a living beast only infuriated her, and as that rage swelled, her own gray and black hide gained a silvery sheen of power. She roared so loudly that my chest and belly shook, and my ears screamed with pain. She caught one zombie in her jaws and flung it away. It sailed up over the nearest 5-story building and out of sight in the darkness and rain. When she stomped down with her foot, she shattered the concrete of a walkway and drove a footprint more than a foot deep into the earth around it. The zombie assault turned into one enormous exercise in suicidal tactics. For whenever one of the undead warriors managed to get through to harm Sue, the Tyrannosaur not only crushed the unlife out of them, but grew that much more angry and powerful and unstoppable. It was like riding a carnivorous earthquake.
"Look!"
Ramirez screamed.
"Look there!"
I followed his nod and spotted Grivain in the circle in his trench coat and fedora. The necromancer was keeping a steady beat on a drum hung from his belt, and he gripped a staff of gnarled, twisted black wood with the other. He stared at us, his face twisted in hatred, and his eyes glittered with insane malice. I willed Sue to head for the circle, but the Tyrannosaur's will was suddenly no longer pliable or easily led. The blood rage and fury of battle had overloaded what little mind she actually possessed, and now she was nothing but several rampaging tons of killing machine.
"Hurry!"
Ramirez shouted.
"She's not listening," I told him.
I applied my will even more forcefully, but it was like one man struggling to hold back a bulldozer. I gritted my teeth, desperately trying to figure a way to get Sue where I wanted her, and hit on one idea. Instead of trying to stop her battle rage, I encouraged it, and then I pointed her at the zombies nearer to the circle. Sue responded with bloodlust and glee, swerving to charge toward the zombies nearest the circle, crushing and re-killing them as she went.
"We have to jump!"
I shouted.
"Woohoo!"
Ramirez cried, his smile blazing white. Sue pursued a dodging zombie to within 10 feet of one of the fallen picnic tables, and I let out a scream of fear and excitement as I jumped. It was like falling from a little bit higher than a second-story window, but I managed to land feet first and well enough to absorb most of the shock of impact, though the flash of pain told me that my knees and ankles were going to be sore for days. I rose and lifted my shield at once, in time to intercept the deadly flash of Gravain's whirling chain.
"Fool," he snarled. "You should have joined me when you had the chance."
His eyes flicked up and glittered. I followed the line of his gaze. The vortex wasn't more than 10 feet from the ground.
"You can't draw it in if I'm standing right here," I shouted back, retreating and circling to get into the circle of picnic tables.
When I did, that horrible, sickly sense of cold faded. This near, the vortex wasn't drawing the life off of me. It was the eye of the metaphysical hurricane.
"One distraction and the backlash will kill you. It's over."
"It is not over," he howled,
and the chain whipped out again, striking my shield.
"It is mine, my birthright. I was his favored child."
I barely heard a footstep behind me and whirled in time to lift my shield against another zombie with a spear. The weapon shattered against my upraised shield, but even as it did, I felt a burning impact as Gravain's chain wrapped around my wounded leg and jerked hard. My balance went out from under me, and I fell to the ground. Gravain's zombie piled onto my back and started biting me. I felt hot, horrible pain on my trapezius muscles left of my neck, even through my cloak and spellwork duster. The zombie let out a vicious cry and let go, then went for the unprotected nape of my neck. I struggled to throw it off of me, to get away, but my battered body was weakened, and it was incredibly strong.
"Die!" Gravain screamed, wild laughter in his unsteady voice. "Die! Die! Die!"
His howls broke off into a single, quiet, choking noise, and the zombie on my back abruptly froze. I struggled out from under it in time to see Gravain standing a few feet away, the chain discarded upon the ground, his hand held to his neck. Blood, black in the night, sprayed from between his fingers. His expression became enraged, and he turned toward me, extending a hand to the zombie near me. The zombie turned, once more with purpose. But then Gravain's expression became puzzled. His eyes rolled back in his head, and I saw the long, straight, smooth cut that had opened his neck from one side to the other, cutting all the way to his spine. Ramirez stepped into my line of vision, his silver sword in hand and coated with blood. In his other hand, he held his pistol. Without hesitation or hurry, he raised the gun and aimed at Gravain's head from 5 feet away. Then he executed the stunned necromancer. The body went loose, fell, and lay there in the grass and rain, one leg twitching. Around us, the zombies had suddenly lost their vibrant animation, and most of them simply stood passively still, staring at nothing. Tyrannosaur Sue couldn't have cared less and carried on with her killing spree. Ramirez came to me and helped me to my feet.
"Sorry it took me so long. I had to dodge some bad guys."
"You got here," I said, panting. He nodded once, grimacing.
"Couldn't shoot with you that close in this light. Had to do it the old-fashioned way. You were one hell of a good distraction, though."
"You did fine," I said. I could feel hot wetness trickling down my back.
Thank God he was insane.
How's that? Ramirez asked.
At the end there. You'd opened his throat, but he still thought he could keep going. He tried to hang on to his control of the zombies. It was like he didn't think death counted when it came to him.
And that's lucky, why?
He refused to believe he was dying, I said. No death curse.
Ramirez nodded.
Yeah, you're right. Lucky us.
Then a man's voice said,
I don't know if I'd say that, gentlemen.
I whirled as one of the passive zombies still standing nearby turned, lifting its spear, and then shimmered into the form of Cowl. He lifted one hand from the folds of his dark cloak, and there was no warning surge of gathering power when a wave of vicious force flickered out from his palm and took Ramirez full in the chest. The young warden hadn't been ready for it. The magical blow lifted him from his feet and threw him backward like a rag doll. He hit the ground 20 feet later, limbs already flopping limply, and lay there without moving.
No! I shouted, and I whirled on Cowl, hellfire erupting from the runes of my staff. I lifted the staff, snarled, Forzari! And sent a lance of vicious energy at the dark figure. Cowl swiftly crossed his hands at the wrists, forming an X shape with his arms, aligning defensive energy before him. But he hadn't been quite swift enough, or else he hadn't reckoned on how much energy he had to deal with. The lash of raw, scarlet force hammered him hard on the right side of his body, spinning him around and stealing his balance. He stumbled in a corkscrewing motion and went to the ground. I drew back the staff for another blow, but then someone pressed against my back, fingers tightened in my hair, and I felt the cold, deadly edge of a knife at my throat.
Don't move,
Kumori's quiet voice said. She was stretched out quite a bit to be pulling my hair and holding the knife, but she'd done it right. There was no way I could try to escape her without her opening an artery. I ground my teeth, my power still ready to lash out again, and debated doing exactly that. Kumori would probably kill me, but it might be worth it to finish Cowl. I looked up at the writhing vortex. Its tip was now barely above the height of my own head. Cowl recovered his feet by slow degrees, shaken more than hurt, and anger radiated from him in nearly palpable waves.
Idiot! He said, voice harsh.
You have lost! Can you not see? The game is over!
Don't do this, I growled. It isn't worth it. You're going to kill thousands of innocent people.
Cowl's hood tilted up toward the descending vortex, and he marched over the grass until he stood directly beneath it.
Keep him still,
he snapped to Kumori.
Yes, Lord,
Kumori replied. The steel at my throat never wavered. Cowl's hand dipped into a pouch at his side and came out holding Bob the Skull. The lights in the skull's eye sockets burned a cold shade of blue and violet.
There, spirit,
Cowl said, holding the skull up to see the vortex.
Do you see it?
Of course, said the skull, his voice just as cold and empty.
It is precisely as the master described. Proceed.
The eye lights swiveled and came to rest on me.
Ah, the White Council's black sheep. I recommend that you kill him immediately. No,
Kumori said firmly.
His death curse could destroy the working. I know that,
the skull replied, his voice contemptuous.
But if he lives when Cowl draws down the power, he might disrupt it. Kill him now. Silence, spirit,
Cowl said in a harsh voice.
You are not the master here. Challenge me again at your own peril.
The skull's eye sockets burned colder yet, but he said nothing. I swallowed. Bob wasn't Bob anymore. I'd known that he was bound and beholden to whoever possessed the skull he resided within, and that their personality would strongly influence his own, but I never really imagined what that might be like. Bob wasn't precisely a friend to me, but I was used to him. In a way, he was family, the mouthy, annoying, irritable cousin who was always insulting you, but who was definitely a Thanksgiving dinner. I had never considered the possibility that one day he might be something else. Something murderous. The worst part was that Bob had given Cowl good advice. My death curse might well mess up this spell, but on the other hand, Cowl did not seem one to be afraid of death curses. If he gave me the chance to wait until he was actually at the delicate moment of drawing down the power, I wouldn't need anything as strong as a death curse to upset his balance. Of course it would kill me. Kumori's blade would see to that, but I could stop him if I was alive when it went down. Cowl set the skull aside on the grass, then raised his hands above his head and let the sleeves fall back from his long, weathered arms covered in old scars. He began a chant in a low voice, steady and strong. The vortex quivered, and then, almost delicately, it began to descend to Cowl, drifting toward him as lightly and slowly as a drifting feather of down. Power rolled through the heavens, the clouds, the whirling vortex. Spirits and swirling apparitions screamed and wailed their tormented replies. Kumori's hands never weakened or wavered, but I could sense that almost every fiber of her attention was directed toward Cowl. I might have one chance. "Bob," I said. "Bob!" The blue eye lights turned toward me. "Think," I said quietly. "Think, Bob. You know me. You've worked with me for years." The blue eye lights narrowed. "Bob," I said quietly, "you've got to remember me. I gave you a name." The skull quivered a little, as if a shudder had run through it, but the eyes continued to burn cold and blue. And then one of them flickered into a shade of its usual orange, then immediately back to cold blue. My heart thudded in sudden excitement. Bob the Skull, my Bob, had just winked at me. Cowl continued his chant, and the clouds spun more and more rapidly. The rain abruptly stopped, as swiftly as if someone had turned off a faucet, and the air filled with spirits, ghosts, apparitions, and specters, caught in some vast and unseen whirlpool that dragged them in accelerating circles. The power in the air made it hard to breathe, and the roar of wailing spirits, vast wind, and an earth-deep rumble grew steadily louder.
"Bob!"
I shouted into the cacophony.
"You have my permission!"
Orange light streaked from the eye sockets of the skull and blazed away from the circle of overturned picnic tables. But even so, I saw Bob's glowing body of energy pulled by the whirling currents of magic. He fought against that horrible vortex, and I suddenly realized that without the shelter of the skull or some other kind of physical body, Bob was no different from any of the other spirit beings trapped in that vast maelstrom. If the Dark Hollow was completed, he too would be trapped and devoured. I thought I saw Bob's form sucked up into the clouds of trapped spirits, but there was too much light and noise for me to be sure of anything. Cowl kept on chanting, and I saw his body arch with tension. Over the next minute or so, he actually physically rose above the ground until his boots were 3 or 4 inches in the air. His voice had become part of the wild storm, part of the dark energy, and it rolled and boomed and echoed all around us. I began to understand the kind of power we were dealing with. It was power as deep as an ocean and as broad as the sky. It was dark and lethal and horrible and beautiful, and Cowl was about to take it all in. The strength it would give him would not make him a match for the entire White Council. It would put him in a league so far beyond them that their strength would mean virtually nothing. It was power enough to change the world, to reshape it after one's own liking. The tip of the vortex spun down, danced lightly upon Cowl's lips, and then slipped gently between them. Cowl howled out the last repetition of his chant, his mouth opening wide. I ground my teeth. Bob hadn't been able to help me, and I couldn't let Cowl complete the spell, even if it killed me. I drew in my magic for the last spell I would ever throw, a blast to slam into Cowl, disrupt the spell, let that vast energy tear him to bits. Kumori sensed it, and I heard her let out a short cry. The knife burned hot on my throat. And then the dinosaur I'd summoned plunged through the clouds of wild spirits and headed directly for Kumori, her eyes blazing with brilliant orange flames. Tyrannosaur Bob let out a bellow and swiped one enormous talon at Kumori. Cowl's apprentice was tough and competent, but no amount of training or forethought can prepare you for the sight of an angry dinosaur coming to eat your ass. She froze for the briefest second, and I turned, shoving away from her. The knife whipped against my throat, and I felt a hot sting. I wondered if that was what Gravaine had felt. There was no more time. I flung myself across the grass, gripped my staff in both hands, and swung it like a baseball bat at Cowl's head. The blow connected, right on what felt like the tip of his upturned jaw, snapping his mouth shut and knocking him to the ground. The vortex abruptly screamed and filled with a furious red light. I choked out a cry and fell down on my right side to the ground, bringing up my shield bracelet and holding it over me in an effort to protect myself from the vast forces now flying free from the botched spell. There was more sound, so loud that no word could accurately describe it. Incandescent lightning, screaming faces, and forms of spirits and ghosts, and trembling earth beneath me. And blackness fell. Chapter 43. When I came to my senses, there was darkness and steady cold rain, and I had sunk up to my neck in a deep well of aching pain. Neither lightning nor thunder played through the skies. I lay there for a moment, gathering my wits, and as I did, the lights of the city began to come on, bit by bit, as the power grids went back online. A booted foot pressed into the ground beside my face, and I followed it up, up, and up, until I saw the horned helmet of the Earl King outlined against the brightening Chicago skyline.
"Wizard, called you forth a mighty hunter tonight. One that has not walked this earth since time gone and forgotten."
"Yeah," I said. "Pretty nifty, huh?" There was a low, wild laugh from that helmet.
"Daring. Arrogant. It pleases me."
He tilted his head.
"And you are poor game at the moment. Because of that, and because you pleased me with your calling of the old hunter, this night you may go free. But beware, mortal. The next time our paths cross, it shall be my very great pleasure to run you down."
There was a gust of cold autumn wind, and the Earl King was gone. I looked around blearily. Every tree in the area was gone, torn off about a foot from the earth. The picnic tables had been torn to splinters. The buildings of the college, especially the museum, looked as if they had been ravaged by a tornado that had torn out great chunks and sections of them. My ribs hurt. I looked down and saw that I'd fallen around Bob the Skull and curled my body around him as I had shielded myself. Orange flame flickered to life in the eye sockets.
"Some show, huh?"
Bob said. He sounded exhausted.
"You had to go get the dinosaur, huh?" I said. "I figured you'd just grab a handy zombie."
"Why settle for wieners when you can have steak?"
the skull said brightly.
"Pretty good idea, Harry, talking to me once Cowl set me on the ground. I didn't want to work for him anyway, but as long as he had the skull... Well, you know how it is."
I grunted.
"Yeah. What happened?"
"The spell backlashed when you slugged Cowl," Bob said. "Did just a bit of property damage."
I coughed out a little laugh, looking around me.
"Yeah. Cowl?"
"Most likely there are little pieces of him still filtering down," Bob said brightly. "And his little dog, too."
"You see them die?" I asked.
"Well, no. Once that backlash came down, it tore apart every enchantment within 100 miles. Your dinosaur sort of fell apart."
I grunted uneasily.
"Oh,"
Bob said.
"I think that warden over there is alive."
I blinked.
"Ramirez?"
"Yeah,"
Bob said.
"I figured that you were a warden now and stuff, and that you would probably want me to help out some other warden. So, just before the Big Bang, I had the dinosaur stand over him, soak up the blast."
I grunted.
"Okay," I said. "We've got to help him, but one thing first."
"What's that?" Bob asked.
I squinted around until I found Gravaine's battered corpse. Then I crawled over to it. I fumbled in the trench coat's pockets until I found Kemmler's slender little book. I squinted around me, but there was no one to look as I put it in my pocket.
"Okay," I said. "Come on, watch my back while I help Ramirez."
"You betcha, boss," Bob said, and his voice was very smug. "Hey, you know what? Size really does matter."
Ramirez made it out of that evening alive. He had 4 broken ribs and 2 dislocated shoulders, but he came through. With Butters' help, I was able to get him, Lucio, and Morgan back to my place. At some point in the evening, Butters had taken off his drum and let Morgan take over the drumming duties while he tried to help Lucio. And as a result, her wound hadn't been quite as fatal as she had thought it would be. They were far too badly hurt to stay at my place, though. And senior council member Injun Joe Listens to Wind himself showed up with 6 more stay-at-home wizards who knew something about medicine and healing to move them to a more secure location.
"I just don't get it," Morgan was telling Listens to Wind. "All of these things happening at once, it can't be a coincidence."
"It wasn't," I heard myself say. Morgan looked at me. The resentment in his eyes hadn't changed, but there was something else there that hadn't been there before. Dare I hope it, some modicum of respect. "Think about it," I said. "All those heavy vampire attacks, just when Cowell and his buddies most needed the White Council not to be involved."
"Are you saying that you think Cowell was using the vampires as a tool?" Morgan asked.
"I think they had a deal," I said. "The vampires throw their first major offensive at the right time to let Cowell pull off this Dark Hollow."
"But what do they get out of it?" Morgan asked.
I glanced at Listens to Wind and said, "The senior council."
"Impossible," Morgan said. "By that time they had to know that the senior council was back in Edinburgh. The defenses there have been built over thousands of years. It would take..."
Morgan paused, frowning. I finished the sentence for him. "It would take a god to break through them and kill the senior council." Morgan stared at me for a long time but didn't say anything. It wasn't long before they left, pulling out the wounded wardens and leaving. It left me with only about 30 minutes to meet Mavra's deadline, but since the phones were up again, I left a message at her number and headed for our rendezvous. I turned up in my grave again, standing over the open hole in the ground as Mavra approached me, this time openly and without melodrama. She faced me over my grave and said nothing. I took the book out of my pocket and tossed it to her. She picked it up, regarded it, and then drew an envelope from her jacket and tossed it at my feet. I picked it up and found the negatives of the incriminating pictures of Murphy inside. Mavra turned to leave. I said, "Wait." She paused. "This never happens again," I said quietly. "You try to get to me through other mortals again, and I'll kill you." Mavra's rotted lips turned up at one corner.
"No, you won't," she said in her dusty voice. "You don't have that kind of power."
"I can get it," I said.
"But you won't," she responded, mockery in her tone. "It wouldn't be right."
I stared at her for a full 10 seconds before I said, in a very quiet voice, "I've got a fallen angel tripping all over herself to give me more power. Queen Mab has asked me to take the mantle of Winter Night twice now. I've read Kemmler's book. I know how the Dark Hollow works, and I know how to turn necromancy against the Black Court." Mavra's filmed eyes flashed with anger. I continued to speak quietly, never raising my voice. "So, once again, let me be perfectly clear. If anything happens to Murphy, and I even think you had a hand in it, fuck right and wrong. If you touch her, I'm declaring war on you. Personally. I'm picking up every weapon I can get, and I'm using them to kill you. Horribly." There was utter silence for a moment.
"Do you understand me?" I whispered.
She nodded.
"Say it,"
I snarled, and my voice came out so harsh and cold that Mavra twitched and took 6 steps back from me.
"I understand," she rasped.
"Get out of my town," I told her.
And Mavra retreated into the shadows. I stood there over my grave for a minute more, just feeling the pain of my battered body and bitterly considering the inevitability of death. After a moment, I felt another presence near me. I looked up and found the dream image of my father regarding my tombstone speculatively. "He died doing the right thing," my father read. "Maybe I can change it to, he died alone," I said back. My father smiled a little.
Thinking about the death curse, huh?
Yeah,
die alone. I stared down at my open grave. Maybe it means I'll never be with anybody. Have love, a wife, children. No one who is really close, really there. Maybe, my father said. What do you think?
I think that's what he wanted to do to me. I think I'm so tired that I'm hallucinating, and that I hurt, and that I want someone to be holding my hand when it's my time. I don't want to do it alone.
Harry, my dad said, and his voice was very gentle, can I tell you something?
Sure.
He walked around the grave and put his hand on my shoulder.
Son, everyone dies alone. That's what it is. It's a door. It's one person wide. When you go through it, you do it alone.
His fingers squeezed me tight. But it doesn't mean you've got to be alone before you go through the door. And believe me, you aren't alone on the other side.
I frowned and looked up at my father's image, searching his eyes.
Really?
He smiled and drew his finger in an X on his chest. Cross my heart. I looked away from him.
I did things. I made a deal I shouldn't have made. I crossed a line.
I know, he said. It only means what you decide it means.
I looked up at him.
What?
Harry, life isn't simple. There is such a thing as black and white, right and wrong. But when you're in the thick of things, sometimes it's hard for us to tell. You didn't do what you did for your own benefit. You did it so that you could protect others. That doesn't make it right, but it doesn't make you a monster either. You still have free will. You still get to choose what you will do, and what you will be, and what you will become.
He clapped my shoulder and turned to walk away. As long as you believe you are responsible for your choices, you still are. You've got a good heart, son. Listen to it.
He vanished into the night, and somewhere in the city, bells started tolling midnight. I stared at my waiting grave, and I suddenly realized that death was really not my biggest worry. He died doing the right thing. God, I hope so.
Thomas was waiting back at my apartment when I returned, and Mouse came loping in not long after. Murphy's bike had failed him completely, and by the time he'd reached the college campus, the fur had flown and the whole show was over. I crashed hard and slept for more than a day. When I woke up, I found that my injuries had all been dressed again, and that an IV was hanging beside my bed. Butters showed up every day to check on me, and he had me on antibiotics and had imposed a ferociously healthy diet on me that Thomas made me stick to. I grumbled a lot and slept a lot and, after several days, was feeling almost human again. Murphy showed up to chew me out for the wreck she found where her house used to be. We'd left the place sort of trashed. But when she saw me in bed, covered in bandages, she stopped in her tracks.
What happened? She asked.
Oh, things, I said. Chicago was interesting for a couple of days there. I peered at her. She had a cast on her left arm, as if for a broken wrist, and I thought I saw the edge of a bruise on her neck.
Hey, I said. What happened?
Her cheeks turned pink.
Oh, things. Hawaii was interesting for a couple of days there.
I'll trade you my story for yours, I said. She got pinker.
I'll have to think about it.
Then we both looked at each other and laughed, and we left it at that. Chicago reacted to the events of that Halloween predictably. It was all attributed to the worst storm in 50 years, rioting, a minor earth tremor, a large load of bread produced by a local bakery that had been contaminated with ergot, and similar Halloween-fueled hysteria. In the blackout, some reprehensible types had vandalized the museum and relocated Sue's skeleton to a local campus as some kind of bizarre practical joke. There had been dozens of break-ins, robberies, murders, and other crimes during the blackout, but any other reports and wild stories were automatically put down to hysteria and/or ergot poisoning. Life went on. Captain Lucio survived her injuries, but not without serious long-term damage that would take a lot of rehabilitation. Between that and the uncertainty of what would happen in her shiny new body, She had been relieved of command as the captain of the wardens, until such time as her health and state of mind were judged to be sound and reliable. Morgan took her place. He came to visit me at my place maybe 2 weeks later and gave me the news.
"Dresden," he said, "I was against inducting you in the first place, but Captain Lucio had the right to ignore my recommendation. She made you a warden, and she made you a regional commander, and there's nothing I can do about that." He took a deep breath. "But I don't like you. I think you are dangerous."
His mouth twisted.
"But I am no longer convinced you do these things out of malice. I think you lack discipline and judgment. You have repeatedly demonstrated your willingness to put yourself in harm's way to protect others. As much as it galls me to admit it, I don't think you have any evil intentions. I think your questionable actions are the result of arrogance and poor judgment. In the end, it matters little why you do it. But I cannot in good conscience condemn you for it without giving you some sort of chance to prove me wrong." From Morgan, this was the equivalent of Emperor Constantine converting to Christianity. He was almost admitting that he had been wrong. I reached into my pocket, pulled out a penny, and dropped it to the floor.
"What was that for?" he asked.
"I'm just making sure gravity is still online," I said. He frowned at me, then shrugged and said, "I don't trust you. I'm not committing any wardens to your command, and truth be told, we don't have them to spare in any case. But you may be required to participate in missions from time to time, and I will expect you to work with the other regional commander in America. He operates out of Los Angeles. He specifically requested the assignment, and given his role in recent events, he could hardly be gainsaid."
"Ramirez," I guessed. Morgan nodded. Then he reached into his coat and produced an envelope. He handed it to me.
"What's this?" I asked.
"Your first paycheck," Morgan said, and he didn't look happy to be saying it. "Monthly."
I opened the envelope and blinked. It wasn't a fortune, but a Chirasol would be a nice little addition to my earnings in the investigation business.
"I never thought I would hear myself say this," I said as he started to leave. "But thank you, Morgan."
His face twisted up into something bitter, and he managed to spit out the words,
"You're welcome."
I think he fled before he started to puke.
Several weeks later, Butters showed up at my door with a big box wrapped in Christmas paper. I let him in, and he carried it to the living room and presented me with it.
"Go ahead, open it."
I did. Inside the box was a guitar case, and inside that, an old wooden guitar. I said, "What's this for?"
"Therapy," Butters said.
He'd been having me practice squeezing a squishy ball with my left hand. And, just as he'd predicted, I had slowly gained a little more control of it.
"You're going to learn to play."
My hand doesn't work that well," I said.
"Not yet," Butters replied. "But we'll start slow like everything else, and you can work up to it. Just do the lessons. Look, there's a book in the bottom of the case."
I opened the case and found a book entitled Guitar for Total Idiots, while Butters went on about tendons and metacarpal something or other and flexibility. I opened the book, but night had fallen, and the fire was too low to let me read it. I absently waved a hand at the candles on the table beside the couch and muttered, "Flick'em bickus." They puffed to light with a little whoosh of magic. I stopped and blinked, first at the candles and then at my burned hand.
"What?"
Butters asked. "Nothing," I said, and opened the book to look over it.
"You know, Butters, for a mortician, you're a pretty good healer." "You think so?"
I glanced at the warm, steady flame of the candles and smiled.
"Yeah."
This is James Marsters. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Deadbeat by Jim Butcher. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruz, produced by David Rapkin, and directed by Bob Walter. Deadbeat is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc., copyright 2010. All rights reserved. The book, Deadbeat, is available wherever rock books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.